This week on The Futurists, Steve Dennis.
You know, if you're not evolving, you're probably dying. And so you've got to really recognize where you've kind of run out of gas in terms of a strategy that's just kind of hit a wall.
Well, welcome back to The Futurist, where every week we bring you one person who is thinking about and shaping and influencing the future. I'm Rob Tursik with my co-host, Brett King.
Yeah. How are we going?
Brett, how you doing, man? I haven't seen you in ages. You good?
No, it feels like that, right? You know, we passing ships in the night and so forth, but I've been really busy on the road, Saudi and Boston last week. And then I've got a week now where I've got to just get the final submission in for the new book. And then off to Mexico and Denver and then Armenia. So
Armenia.
Yeah.
Wow. So you're like on a mission to get like put a check in the box on every country in the world.
Well, you know, I don't know. I'm HSBC said if I visit North Korea, I'm in trouble. They'll close my bank account. So
most, but not
that's
all.
That's one that I won't be going
fair
to.
Enough. Yeah, probably not a country that's really worth the trip.
Probably.
And you're down in from Bangkok again, right?
Yes. Yeah. So just very got back cool. to Bangkok on the weekend, and I'm sure we'll talk about this at some point, but getting into some really interesting longevity stuff at the moment. So,
fabulous. Yeah. Good. We can chat a bit about that. So, you know, one of the things I used to love about travel, a few years back, let's say about 10 years ago, one of the things I used to really enjoy about traveling is going to shops, to going to stores, because you see how people live and you see what things they have to buy and you get a glimpse of the consumer economy, whatever that means in whatever country you're in. And I used to really enjoy that because I found it kind of intriguing because everything was a little bit different. And then somewhere along the line, about 10 years ago, this kind of global sameness set in. And I noticed that like every store had the same products and all the same brands were in every shopping mall around the world. It doesn't matter where you go. There's a Burberry store. There's going to be some brand that you're familiar with. The same products you can get at home. And it took just a little bit of the joy out of travel. It didn't kill travel for me, but that idea of the fun part of going and exploring in a store and discovering stuff you'd never seen before and kind of getting curious about other people's lifestyles, that got zapped.
Now you've got to get out of the mall. I mean, that's the answer, I guess. But, you know, and the food still is differentiated, I feel.
Yeah, the food for sure.
Yeah, but the retail experiences, you're absolutely right. You go into the malls and... You know, you could be in Berlin or you could be in London or Denver or, New Zealand, Auckland, and pretty much you're going to see the same chain.
The same products, the same or similar products. So about 10 years ago, I crossed paths with a person who's focused on this subject and has made his whole career out of understanding the future of retail. And retail is an interesting thing, right? Not everybody thinks there are futures, but everybody shops in a store. And so as a result, we're all exposed to that version of the future. So this week, I'm really excited to have a guest, Steve Dennis. I've wanted the book for a long time on the show. Steve is the author of Remarkable Retail, and his forthcoming book, his new book, is called Leaders Leap. Hey, Steve, welcome to The Futurist. It's great to have you here.
Well, thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Yeah, this should be good fun. Hey, quickly, give us the temperature right now in the retail industry, because pre-pandemic, it was a bloodbath. You know, 2017, 2018 were very, very tough years for U.S. retailers in particular. A lot of national chains went out of business in those years. And certainly the pandemic didn't help matters much. So here we are, 2024. What's it like in the retail industry today?
Well, to a certain degree, it's more of the same. One of the phrases that I use a lot and I get a little bit of heat for is this idea of bifurcation. Mm. When you actually look, I mean, as much as people talk about the retail apocalypse, you know, what we had mostly was what I call the collapse of the middle. We continue to see and have seen for a long time quite a lot of success on the value side of the equation, whether we're talking about Amazon or Walmart or Costco or what have you, and a fair amount of success on the higher end, whether that's LVMH or it's Lululemon or what have you. But the trouble, which has been brewing for a long time, has been in this kind of undifferentiated middle. So we saw
companies like Macy's, like the big department stores.
Absolutely, yeah. Department stores are kind of the poster child.
Yeah.
For this. Yeah. But Bed Bath and Beyond, right, et cetera.
Yeah.
So one way to look at it is success has been redistributed, which is to say, you know, it used to be big department stores and actually big box stores drew most of the action. Now it's either high-end retail, some sort of fancy designer boutique stores, or frankly, stores for people who don't have much money. It's a reflection of income inequality, right? So you've got a lot of poor people and a handful of rich people, and retail's catering to those two groups.
Yeah, the demographics are definitely a contributing factor, but I would say a lot of it has been, and I don't know, at one level, this seems pretty obvious, though a lot of retailers fail to recognize this, is, you know, if you think about, not to get into too much of a history lesson, so I'll keep it short, but if you go back to what defined retail in the mid-90s, let's say, the vast majority of retail was done in a physical store. It meant somebody had to go someplace, see what was on offer, maybe talk to salespeople, what have you. You know, other than a mail order catalog, that was retail. In an era of e-commerce, in an era of smart devices, et cetera, suddenly you've got this world of abundance, right? You can get access to almost anything you want 24/7 from almost anywhere in the world. And so before, you just had to be a little bit better than the guy down the street or down the mall or what have you. Now you're in competition with the universe. And so if you're just kind of average or serviceable or even very good, you may not get noticed anymore. Mm-hmm. And even if you get noticed, you may not get engaged with or develop that relationship. So part of the collapse of the middle is these peak of the bell curve sort of retailers, whether that's the Bed Bath & Beyonds or the department stores, which are a little bit of everything to everybody, but they're not great on the value and convenience side, nor are they great on having something differentiated in terms of product, service, environment, what have you. So those pressures have been amassing for a long period of time. Department stores in particular have had 20-something years of negative overall sales. So that's not new. But I think as the pace of change continues to accelerate, a lot of these retailers have fixed costs. The pressures just continue to be put on those that
so it sounds really like that whole middle segment is essentially being consumed by the online world. And then you've got the differentiation at the high end with the Louis Vuittons and so forth, as you mentioned.
They
can still stay differentiated, but.
Yeah, it's a little bit too pithy, I would say, to blame it online. Like, you know, I always say nothing prevents Macy's from having a good online site, right? Sure. It has much more to do with whether the brand is highly relevant and differentiated, which might include online. But Amazon gets way too much blame for challenging these businesses. It's relatively overlap.
Because Walmart has done reasonable online as an example, they're middle, but
you could talk as much as you want about the retail apocalypse, but when you put Amazon to the side, the most successful profitable growing retailers are overwhelmingly concentrated in physical stores, and they're great online. You know, Ulta, Tractor Supply, I mean, you go through down the list of very, very successful stores, they have been opening stores, they have had positive physical store growth. So, you know, you have to really understand, you know, when it comes to what I call, you know, you can call it jobs versus joys or errands versus experiences. The more you get on that side of value and ease of experience, that's where online does really well. But when you get to the other side of the equation, most journeys start in a digital world, but the actual transactions and the brand experience is overwhelmingly the brick and mortar experience. And that's not changing.
Just before the pandemic, there was a trend where you could start a brand online and then open a retail shop, things like Warby Parker or Bonobos, the kind of men's clothing store. How did those fare during the pandemic? I'm sure all those shops ended up closing during the pandemic. Is that still a thing?
It's mixed. I mean, that whole story is a little bit complicated. This idea, you know, one of the dumbest things, and, you know, he's a very wealthy man. I'm sure he's very smart, et cetera. But Marc Andreessen made one of the stupidest statements of all time, which was in the future, all retail would be done online. And since he said that, physical retail has continued to grow. So there's a very fundamental misunderstanding, and it led to incineration of a lot of cash because there was this idea you could build these big, powerful brands online only. And, you know, the total addressable market for many of those brands has just turned out to be much smaller. But as you pointed out, many of them concluded that, aha, they're going to need these things called stores. And some of that had to do with just understanding that, you know, 80% of all sales are still done in physical stores. Physical stores are great advertising for online. And so there was a misunderstanding, a fundamental poor premise to that development. But it's been a very mixed bag in terms of those retailers. Warby Parker, still not profitable, but getting closer to that. Bonobos was bought by Walmart for $300 million and then was sold to Express for, I think, $15 million. Whoa. So, Real Stitch Fix, a bunch of these hot brands, all their stocks are down about 90%+. Johnny Cupcake, I'm not so sure. But so we really haven't seen kind of this revolution from some of these so-called digitally native vertical brands. In fact, it's a bit ironic that, which is off your question, I know, but as much as people talk about like direct-to-consumer vertically integrated brands being a new thing, they of course are not new. Abercrombie and Fitch, for example, just reported amazing results. And, you know, they're what I call an analog vertical native brand. So, you know, there was kind of this hype around these are so new because they start online. It's like, well, you know, people started in catalog and then open stores. Like, this is not a new phenomenon. But a lot of people really misunderstood some of the fundamental shopping dynamics, but mostly they understood how much money.
It's interesting you bring up Abercrombie and Fitch. I think of them and Orvis and a couple of those British hunting brands. They managed to pivot in a very interesting way because they were kind of crusty. If you think back to like when we were kids, those brands were not known as cutting edge. They were kind of like LL Bean, you know, like outdoor gear. And it was pretty boring. It was like for duck hunters or something. And somewhere along the line,
turns out it's not a huge market.
Yeah. And somewhere along the line, they hired like designers who were like, we are going to make outdoor gear cool. And, you know, kind of Banana Republic should get the credit for this because they figured it out. Like they kind of created Indiana Jones was their original idea way back in the 80s, you know, where the stores had trees in them and stuff. That's all gone. Now they've become a version of J. Crew. But Abercrombie and Fitch went super hip. Remember when they used to have like those like burly muscled dudes hanging out with no shirt in front of the store in New York in the middle of the winter? And it was like, you know, oh, here's some beefcake to attract female customers into our store. And it worked for 15 minutes. And then they had to pivot again after the pandemic.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's just at the risk of stating the obvious, there's very few brands. I mean, there's certainly some classic iconic brands, but, you know, if you're not evolving, you're probably dying. And so you've got to really recognize where you've kind of run out of gas in terms of a strategy that's just kind of hit a wall.
I think it's what someone said to me. I think it might have been you who said, retail's not dead. It's boring retail that's dead.
Yeah.
People want experiences and people want a reason to leave the house. And if all you've got is a big box with no service and the same products I can find anyplace else, guess what? You're not going to get me to go there because I'm not interested in traveling all the way to the store and finding a parking spot and dealing with the traffic if I'm just going to have a boring experience. I noticed that the Simon Real Estate, the mall developer, Simon Realty, has now made a massive investment in Minneapolis. The $400 million being poured into a shopping mall that is entirely focused on experiences, things like high-end spas and so on. And they're ripping down whole buildings and replacing them with new structures. So tell us about the state of the shopping mall right now. What's the future of the shopping mall?
Well, in general, we've seen what I call kind of the dispersion of retail, which is retailers in general move closer to the customer, whether that's online or it's in more neighborhood centers. So even in the physical world, you see a tremendous amount of success in, say, off-price retail. You know, TJ Maxx and those guys have opened, you know, hundreds, thousands of stores over the last few years. But most of those tend to be closer to the customer and kind of more of your neighborhood. When it comes to the mall, I have kids who are 26 and 30. And I said, you know, when I first started in retail, malls were actually convenient to go to. And they meant, well, how is a mall convenient? And I said, because all the good retailers were all in one place. You didn't have this aside from online, you just didn't have this proliferation of different concepts. So it was actually efficient to go there. But, you know, that has just massively shifted in the last 20 or 30 years. So now to your point, I think you've got to give the customer a really good reason. And, you know, you can make an argument that physical experiences actually mean more in a digital world because we do have this split between kind of ease versus experience. So what Simon and a lot of others are doing are really reconceptualizing these malls so you don't have this big, vast, crazy space. Like every time I go to one of these big malls, I'm like, oh my God, like this is the worst place to shop because they're massive. A third of the stores have no relevance anymore. So trying to make them more intimate, trying to go from, say, 300 stores where a bunch of them don't really make any sense to some really special stores that people really want to go to, whether that's the Apple Store or RH or whatever, Eataly, whatever that might be. But also mixing it in so-called these ideas of kind of lifestyle centers. So you've got some apartments, maybe you have a hotel, maybe have, you know, an amazing, you know, food hall or something really amazing from a dining experience. And so you've got a reason not only to go see some stores that are unique, but you're also going there to do other things. So this isn't an entirely new concept. This idea of open air lifestyle centers has been something that's been around in retail.
I mean, arguably, it's what Main Street used to be when we were all kids back in the 60s and 70s. There was Main Street, right? And then that all got siphoned away by the shopping mall. And then the big box stores came in the 80s. And then the big box stores got crushed by internet. So like you say, it's successive waves of innovation.
But people, so I think you're going to see most malls. Proximity. Yeah, and I think you're going to see, I mean, we're social creatures as much as, you know, I really think, and, you know, it's a little too black and white to say that the world is divided into, you know, errands versus experiences. But I think, you know, as I've talked to people about it, and you really think about how we invest our time, there's a set of things where we're not that emotionally connected to the brand. We just want to get something off our to-do list, right? Or we're willing to invest a little bit of energy, but getting a new, you know, pair of running shorts is not, you know, an experience in and of itself if you just need to replace something, right? But then there's this whole world where you really care about how you spend your time and what you're getting, either because you really care, you know, you're decorating your home and you're going to spend the time to get that perfect sofa or what have you, or you're doing something really, really socially interesting and different. So you're going out to eat, you're going to a movie, whatever that might be. And so I do think in a way there is this kind of fork in the road. And again, the people that straddle it, you know, that haven't picked the lane tend to be the ones that are in trouble. But for malls, you know, you're never going to be the most convenient place when you're a big regional mall. So I think
let me jump in here, Steve, and sort of challenge you on this, because this seems to be, you know, I live in Bangkok and the malls are the place to go here. Right. That's where everybody meets up. And, you know, from it's still very much the mall culture, but the malls here are very different from what they are in regional United States.
Oh, so tell me.
Same for Dubai and so forth. You know, they are rich cultural entertainment hubs, you know. So, yes, they have all the stores and they have all the best brands. They have the Apple and all of that, but they have these. So, for example, in Icon Siam, which is, you know, a couple of kilometers down the road from here, they have in like this little Thai village inside, which doubles as the food court. You know, you've got bands playing and things like that throughout it. You know, it's really a dynamic environment. There's cinemas there. A lot of people are coming through for the cinemas and the entertainment stuff. There's kids play areas and things like that. So it's very much designed for you to go there and spend, you know, a considerable amount of time at. And then you've got Dubai Mall and Mall of the Emirates, you know, with the ski slope in the middle of it and so forth. And you can pretty much go to those malls in Dubai all year round, and they're packed full of locals. And so I think, you know, there is a cultural element to, you know, the mall design in these places that it is more to make it experiential. I wonder if that's, you know, in the cookie cutter sort of approach to mall building in America, is that now, you know, a disadvantage as we're shifting to sort of more experiential elements in retail?
I think it's a disadvantage. I mean, I do think that, you know, my experience as I've traveled globally is that you still do see some of these malls that are really powerful. And I do think they started with a premise of being more experiential to begin with, you know, the food offering stronger, obviously you got the ski slopes, you know, those kinds of things in Dubai. I can't speak, I don't know as much about the cultural differences, but, you know, one of the things, I've spent a fair amount of time in Dubai. I mean, aside from the fact that, you know, in North America, you have big mall developers that kind of stamped out the same thing regardless of the climate. So I think, you know, in warmer places, it makes more sense to go someplace. You don't necessarily have that, or you have that to varying degrees in North America. I think, you know, the other thing which is characteristic of some markets that's quite different than the US is you don't have this expanse. And so, you know, there's a lot more off the mall competition in the US. You know, you don't have nearly off price kind of retail, or you don't have the Home Depots and Lowe's kinds of Best Buy format so much in a lot of global markets. And those have been things that have taken a lot of traffic away from the malls and made the North American malls much weaker than I think you see in the Middle East and throughout most of Asia. So I think there are some important differences. I do think that it's been amazing to me, actually, And there's probably all sorts of reasons of I don't know what, being too self-centered, that some of the U.S. malls haven't learned more from what's quite successful in other parts of the world.
Yeah.
So now they
yeah.
seem well, to be slowly getting there.
That's the case in many industries in the United States. You know,
one of the things that's different, like, I want to build on what Brett brought up a little bit about the international dynamic. You know, many Americans assume that other people in other countries live the way Americans do in a, you know, a split ranch home in a suburbs place. Right. But the reality is most people in the world live the way Japanese do, which is the whole family's in an apartment in a dense urban area. And for people who live in places like that, candidly, you have two avenues of escape, right? One is the smartphone and the other one is a shopping mall. It's like a place you get out of the house and go to. So if you have that dynamic, that's going to help the malls considerably. And public transport is another one. You know, one of the great things about Bangkok is they keep building more and more public transport so kids can get around, right? Yeah. The United States seems to be going the other direction. Well, it's time for us to go to a break now. So, Steve, we're going to take a short break here, but we'll be right back after this short announcement. And then we'll be back with Steve Dennis on The Futurists. Hang tight.
Provoke Media is proud to sponsor, produce, and support The Futurist podcast. Provoke.fm is a global podcast network and content creation company with the world's leading fintech podcast and radio show, Breaking Banks. And of course, its spin-off podcasts, Breaking Banks Europe, Breaking Banks Asia Pacific, and the Fintech Five. But we also produce the official Finovate podcast, Tech on Reg, Emerge Everywhere, the podcast of the Financial Health Network, and Next Gen Banker. For information about all our podcasts, go to provoke.fm or check out Breaking Banks, the world's number one fintech podcast and radio show.
All right, we're back. It's The Futurists with myself and Rob Tursek. We are talking to Steve Dennis today. And, you know, Steve, we were talking about the sort of the macro changes in retail and so forth. But I want to talk about the technology application, because obviously, you know, we are starting to see robotics, you know, certainly in warehousing, you know, we see it in some stores for cleaning and so forth. You know, I walk around some of the airports in the world now and they have robotic vacuum cleaners and so forth. But in retail space, we've seen experiments with some technology, like with Amazon Go and with the self service checkout stuff. And now we see in the UK, for example, they're removing many of these self-service checkout stations and sort of bringing back cashiers. So, what is the right play in respect, or the right balance in respect to technology in these experiences that we've learned from these experiments the last few years?
Well, I think there's a few things going on there. One is, and I always say that you know, nobody really cares, or customers don't care about technology. They care about the job they're trying to get done. And if technology can help them get what they want, then they're interested in it. But it's not about technology. I think too many companies fall in love with the technology as opposed to the solution. But, you know, there's a lot of factors that are driving an embrace, or a higher degree of embrace, I guess, of technology. One is just the labor shortage. And I don't see any evidence that, in most countries anyway, that the labor shortage is going to get meaningfully better. So looking at automation, whether that's robotics, whether that's artificial intelligence, you know, generative AI is obviously getting a lot of attention. I think that the pressures to push on that will continue to be great just by virtue of the labor issues. The counterbalance, counterbalances, I think, just quickly. In the case of things like self-checkout or Amazon Go kind of technology is, you know, to what degree are you helping the customer experience, or you're doing it for your own reasons? And then on second factor is we've seen a pretty significant growth in theft. So, it's one thing to say, well, I can't afford to have so much staff on the floor. But then if the offset to that is your losses go up quite a lot and consumers tend to push back on it, then you're only going to go so far with automation. So I think we'll continue to see companies experiment with lots of different new approaches. Technology is always getting better, it seems. And so, you know, something that maybe is not working right this moment may be very workable in a year or two. So I don't think we're in any kind of static mode at all.
You know, it's interesting, the observation. Rob and I often have this debate about how AI is going to impact employment. And when we're looking at retail, one of the core issues is that, you know, and this is a problem not just in the US, it's also a problem in the UK, Australia, and so forth, which is the, you know, typical service worker roles in retail are typically sort of near minimum wage. And right. you just can't find people at that level because they can't afford to live on minimum wage anymore. You know, there's not a single right. state in the US where you can afford a one-bedroom home on minimum wage 40 hours a week today, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. Very similar situation in Sydney and elsewhere. So it's like, so that's why we're going to be pushing for automation instead of like raising salary for service workers as an example. But this is a strong impetus, you know, for automation being injected into retail. But then it leaves you with this situation where you've got lower to middle income households, you know, much more adversely affected by loss of access to, you know, minimum wage jobs like that, that, you know, sure. you could survive off. So this is a pretty good argument for something like universal basic income. But, you know, you can see the momentum for automation coming into a sector like retail here, just because yeah, of those
you're
dynamics.
You're bringing universal basic income into this. So basically what you're saying is that we should confiscate the wealth of Americans in order
I'm just saying that of
major retailers.
No, you the problem isn't...
Walmart's already doing that. Hang on, let me finish. You went for a long time. Let me say this. Come on. Walmart is already doing that, right? Walmart isn't even paying people minimum wage. They're hiring people as part-time workers.
This is the point.
On 40 hours a week. They're making it impossible for people to raise a family. They're forcing them to do clopening where they have to be at the opening shift and the closing shift while the kids are in school in the middle of the day and there's no one home to watch the kids at night. They're destroying working family lives. And those people are on food stamps because they don't get paid enough to support their families. So, in fact,
they're setting a benchmark.
Subsidizing major retail in the United States. This is not a good argument for universal basic income.
No. But I'm saying, no, it's an argument that the market is.
I was told there wouldn't be any
automation. The argument is we're pushing towards this automation to fix this because we're not willing to pay people a proper amount. Right.
There you go. Now you're saying it. That's the quiet part. That's exactly
That's the real issue.
And they don't want to deal with workers, so they just want to put robots in place. But people don't like it, right?
The most efficient form of productivity is eliminating human labor, right?
Yeah, look, the way they do it is they push the labor onto the customer, right? So I go to Home Depot or go to the grocery store and I have to scan my own groceries. And I'm like, hey, do benefits come with this job? Do I get a break? Do I get a coffee break every 15 minutes when I'm scanning my own groceries? Are you going to give me a discount?
You got a staff discount? Yeah, exactly. Sorry, Steve. We sort of
jump in, Steve. We're not letting you get a word in edgewise.
I think there's certain aspects that are sort of, you know, these immutable forces, and you know, labor shortage and the desire to use technology is just part of it. But these are complicated issues, and sometimes, you know, we're counting on companies to try to solve things that you can make a very good argument the government should be involved with, depending upon your point of view. So, I think you have to assume that, at least in the United States, the government's not going to come along and solve this problem. So you have to figure out as a retailer, what's your best course going forward. And you know, there's a lot of just trade-offs. And this is probably so obvious, I shouldn't even say it, but you know, you're always trying to balance effectiveness versus efficiency, right? I mean, there's lots of things that seem like easy solutions, but yes, they often get customer pushback for whatever reason. Either they're too complicated to use, or you get resentment because you're suddenly having to do all this work. And I thought you were paying, you know, I'm here paying for a service. Why do I have to take on more responsibilities? So, you know, I think we are, though, as much as people maybe got used to a certain amount of aggravation during the peak of COVID, I do think we're settling in to, I don't really like the new normal kind of language so much, but I think we're in a bit more of our new life here in terms of what the pressures are going to be. And that includes labor shortage, that includes a lot more technology than perhaps we've been used to or want.
Okay, so Steve, here's a question for you. I want to talk about data. Because that's the other aspect. There's another contentious topic. About 10 years ago, I went to the big retail show, the big show, and I was interested to notice that all the major tech companies were there. And that was one of the first years where Microsoft and Oracle and all these huge technology companies showed up. And what they showed up with was a retail version of surveillance capitalism. We didn't use that term at the time because the Shoshana Zubrock's book hadn't come out at that point, but it was emergent, right? The retailers were desperate for a way to fight back against e-commerce. At the time, that was viewed as the big threat. This is about 10 years ago. E-commerce was booming, right? And so they said, gee, maybe we can track people's behavior in our stores. And there were all these technologies introduced at that time for facial recognition, to recognize your best customers, or to recognize people who are shoplifters and escort them politely out the door. There was a way to check people's facial expressions. And I remember watching the demonstration of this. It was great because it would register if you were smiling and it would say glee. And most of the faces were horrified and angry. The expressions that kept showing up, they had to like disable the demo because the people who were looking at it were just freaked out about this. So what happened? Did the retailers actually end up adopting surveillance capitalism in the store? Were they able to track people and do heat maps of, you know, user locations in the store and optimize it the way you would optimize a website?
Well, there's some of that going on. I think a lot of it in the last few years has been driven by trying to connect the dots between digital and physical. You know, you have a much better attribution on a website, and so you can use that to dissect problems, but mostly you can use that to try to personalize, make more relevant the experience, and that's a lot more difficult in a physical store. So there's been lots of different efforts to try to connect the dots, to try to individually recognize customers. You know, part of the big problem in retail is usually, and I worked at Neiman Marcus for many years, and we were actually quite lucky that we had a very elaborate clienteling system. We had a high penetration on our loyalty program, so we could tie transactions online or offline together and use that for some of our modeling. But typically, we didn't know you were you until you were done shopping, right? So we couldn't, I mean, our salespeople might know you. And
it was at the credit card swipe that you got the info. You
right.
The dots.
Right. So some of the facial recognition stuff. Right.
Well, this is where Neiman Marcus, you bring them up, they got in a lot of trouble. Again, this is like 10 years ago, but they were using facial recognition and they didn't disclose it and people found out and customers freaked out about it. But now fast forward to today, every stadium, every arena, and every airport in the United States is introducing facial recognition. And it's sort of like, we don't care what you think. Here it is. It's a fact of life. Are retailers using face recognition now? Is that
something? Not so much. I haven't seen a great adoption of that.
Well,
I think some of
China.
This is, well, I think, you know, some of we, you know, what you're trying, I guess, and I'll just sort of back up and say, the most powerful brands of any kind, retail or otherwise, are built on trust. And if you're doing things that undermine trust fundamentally, and you're not being respectful of how you use data, I think there's just many
I've got a counter to that, which is something I've observed in the fintech space, because that's what we always used to say about bank branches. But you've now got these digital players like Alipay and Tencent WeChat Pay in China, M-Pesa, MTN in Africa, you know, and you know, Nubank in Latin America. And these guys have significantly higher trust ratings than the traditional banks with physical stores. And I think part of that is utility. That, you know, you talked about the mission that people want when they go into a retail store. They're on mission to pick up this and pick up that and go and look at this for, you know, the kids' graduation or whatever. And so they're on mission. And there's an efficiency component to that, that if you can deliver that flawlessly at high volume and very, you know, rapidly and so forth, that the customers learn to trust that as well. I mean, I would say, do people trust Amazon? I would say people trust Amazon.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
they did. They did. Although Amazon is in the process of doing what Cory Doctorow calls enshittification of their service. Forgive me for the language, but you know, like Amazon Prime, suddenly with advertising, people are going, I don't really know if I want to pay $130 a year to this giant company. Let's talk about the two giant companies. So let's talk about Google and let's talk about Amazon. I was stunned to learn from Evan Shapiro just the other day that 70% of the advertising on YouTube. First of all, YouTube is the number one streaming service in the home on television. People don't think of it. We think of YouTube on the phone or something, or YouTube on a computer, but it's on the TV set, the connected TV. Yeah. And YouTube is 70% of the ads on YouTube are performance marketing. And that's because Google dominates in AI-driven ad targeting. They're great at it and they can deliver results. So an advertiser spends $1.75 and they earn $2.50 back, and they're going to do that all day long because that's a fantastic right. business model. Traditional TV can't compete. So traditional TV is getting crushed. Brand advertising is shrinking. It used to be 60-70% was brand advertising, and the rest was other kinds of performance. It's flipped now. Right. Online, performance advertising now is growing to becoming the dominant part. And as I said, on YouTube, it's 70% of the ads. That's an enormous shift. Now, for the people who are listening, there's a direct connection between advertising and retail, obviously. You spend money on TV, and then hopefully people show up in your store. But there's never been a great way to correlate that and extract like some performance metrics right. to prove that they saw the ads. How do you make that connection? What's happening now, because companies like Amazon are rushing in, and because Google's got such a dominant position in the home TV, is that you're able now to connect the dots directly and say, we ran that ad and the person clicked and they made a purchase. Right. So Amazon as a TV company, we tend to think of Amazon Prime, which is their video service that competes with Netflix. It's part of the Prime subscription bundle, but that's not their only video service. They also own Twitch, which is a live streaming platform that's incredibly Huge. Successful with young people. Huge. And right. they have Amazon Live. And when you add all that up, they're as big as Netflix. People don't realize that. You know, we tend to think Amazon Prime is tiny relative to Netflix.
Yeah.
But it turns out the tiny company in this space is Netflix itself. They are the dominant player in media and television, streaming video, but they're not that big in retail.
And look at TikTok. Look at TikTok, what it's done with short form video, you know?
And they're also into clickable video and performance. Yeah. It's working, right? So Steve, can you talk about that shift? Because I think this is one that's going to catch the retailers and traditional media flat-footed.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's been huge. The other thing, which is related, is this idea of retail media networks. And, you know, as much as people look at Amazon and they say, oh, you know, the only place they make money is Amazon Web Services. Well, actually, some people have tried to calculate this. You could actually argue right now the most profitable business at Amazon overall is Amazon advertising. It's massively grown and it's got a very, very high margin. So, you know, there's lots of, you know, you can argue we're all in this battle for attention, right? And then there's just all these different places where we end up, whether we're watching Netflix, whether we're shopping on Amazon, whether we're in a store, and people are trying to figure out how to monetize that. And to your point, how do I better connect the dots between what I do and what ultimately the customer ends up doing, particularly in a world, you know, more cookie-less world. You know, there's a lot of issues of, you know, first-party data, third-party data, which is probably a whole hornet's nest to go into. But
we're not afraid of the hornet's nest, as you probably have noticed.
Well, but I think one of the more interesting, I mean, I think, again, you know, another immutable force is that these retail media networks are going to grow, the shoppable video of various types is going to continue to grow.
Tell our listeners what you mean by that, because I don't think people understand what retail media is. It's sort of like cellovision, which was the original idea back in the 90s when we were doing interactive TV, the idea that you could do TV commerce.
Yeah. Well, there's a few types. So there's, I mean, one easy way to think about it is if you're watching YouTube or you're watching a TikTok video, that there's advertising, you know, something clickable or whatever within that piece. So you see this item and you can buy it, or an ad pops up and you go straight to buy it. The idea of retail media networks is a little bit different, and there's on-site advertising. So the easiest one to understand, I'm sure, for most people is if you go to, and Amazon is about 70% of the retail media network volume at the moment. Walmart's a distant number two. But you go on Amazon's main retail site and, you know, you've got sponsored ads, you've got all sorts of things popping up where, you know, they're injecting what an advertiser is paying for to try to get you to buy that particular item. So there's on-site advertising like that. But we're starting to see a lot of growth within physical stores where advertising is starting to appear. So, you know, that could be little tags, that could be a banner that's hanging, that could be, you know, the thing you get on the gas station pump, you know, where an ad comes up to try to sell you something else. So it's been growing. Retail media networks have been growing like crazy. As I mentioned, still overwhelmingly dominated by Amazon. But even companies like Macy's, I think, had about $60 million this past year in revenues from their retail media network. So some of this is driven by just the shifts in, you know, some of the shifts we've talked about and how media in general is working. Some of this is being driven, frankly, by underperforming retailers who are trying to figure out, well, how else can we make some money? And if we've got people coming to our website, coming to our stores, is there an opportunity to sell them something else? But instead of selling, you know, the shirt with, or the tie with the shirt, we could sell you, I don't know, life insurance policy with your shirt or something.
I mean, Walmart like in a way is starting to do this, right? That's why they bought Vizio. Vizio has fast channels. And so they're selling TVs that come with channels. And now Walmart's going to presumably turn those into like television channels where you can click and buy what you're watching. So is this the future that we're going to be in, that television is going to basically become a clickable shopping stream? Is that one of the futures that you envision?
I think that's a big part of the future. The thing that I worry about, and some people tell me I worry about it too much, is, you know, there's this balance between, you know, if I use this example, like if I go to a restaurant and somebody, you know, suddenly jumped out of the side and said, hey, do you need life insurance? Right. That would be very offensive because I am there for a particular experience. And now, you know, you're using interruption marketing to try to sell me something. And yeah, every once in a while, I'm like, oh, it turns out I do need some life insurance. Right. But I often think about, well, if I'm watching a TV show, or if I'm watching a video, or I'm shopping at Home Depot, or whatever it might be, how far can you inject the desire of the advertiser into that experience and not have it be offensive or turn me off or undermine the fundamental reason I'm engaged in your brand? So I think there's a balance that will be achieved. I don't know what that looks like yet because we're still in pretty early days, but I think Amazon's website, you know, back to what you said earlier, I mean, the Amazon shopping experience to me has gotten demonstrably worse over the last several years. And I think some of that is because they're making so much money in advertising, they're going to keep pushing that because it's so profitable for them, but it undermines. But, you know, I think it's a bit of a misnomer to even think of Amazon as a retailer anymore. Sure. You know, it's like, you know, retail is like selling the razor
and the
advertising is the blades.
How does AI play a role? Give us a forecast of artificial intelligence in retail. Where will that play?
And also mixed reality stuff like smart glasses and things like that, you know?
So AI, I think, on the effectiveness side, we're going to see a lot of use of AI to make the shopping experience more personalized or accelerated. So you can imagine a world where instead of, you know, now you try to search for something and you just get a list of things, you're going to be able to get much more, you know, almost like the way a sales associate would deal with you. You know, tell me a little bit about yourself. Here are the three jackets you need for that trip or whatever. So I think search is going to be radically improved. And there's a lot going on right now. I think a year or two from now, we're going to see huge differences. But a lot of the targeting, you know, you talked about how Google's gotten so much more effective at targeting the advertising. Same kind of thing is going to happen.
That's all AI.
Retailers using their data. AI, super powerful. I know of several companies that are seeing really great results. So on the effectiveness side, I think personalization, more relevance, shorter customer journey to what it is you're there to do. We're also going to see a ton of automation. You know, you can create videos with, you know, little human interaction. So when you think about product listing pages or what have you, those could be much more dynamic. And so a lot of the labor that goes into that or the current use of technology is going to be quite different. So so I think there'll be a lot of productivity as well. I'm really struck. I don't know if you heard Klarna talk about the payments, buy now, pay later firm, talk about how they were able to eliminate 700 jobs by using AI. So I think a lot of, you know, more rote functions that are pretty characteristic in kind of back offices of retailers, there's going to be a pretty big impact.
Brett can't wait for me to eat my words on UBI. He loves it. Every time we hear about people being displaced by AI, he's like, see, Rob, I told you. I've been telling you.
No, it's not that. Like, I do think, like, for example, experientially, I think there's a huge range of new jobs that humans will create when we have more leisure time as a result of automation. But the speed of which AI is going to impact the workforce,
it's happening now,
such that we won't have the time to respond, and you'll have immense social pressure to have a response to that displacement of workers happening so rapidly.
It's true. The tech industry has laid off 700,000 people in the last three years. It's astounding.
And that's just the start. Every industry will be a technology industry in the future.
Because so, Wall Street loves it, right?
The market loves it.
The share price is high.
Right.
I remember. Yep. So Steve, back to one of the questions that Brett brought up earlier. Brett asked about augmented reality and virtual overlays and the shopping experience. Is that happening? Is that going to come soon? Will we have to wear special goggles to walk around Walmart and see some wonders?
Well, I might sound like a Luddite, but I heard somebody say about a year ago, well, first of all the predictions about VR, AR, et cetera, in shopping have been woefully wrong. There's a book, I sort of make fun because we're sort of competitive. I'm not going to say his name, but this guy wrote a book who's supposedly a retail futurist. And it's really fun to go back and read how much he got wrong about
things.
But sure.
But he's only wrong until he's right. And then it'll be like,
he's only wrong until he's right. Well, one of the things that I heard somebody say about virtual reality was it's the only technology that makes both online shopping and physical shopping worse. And, you know, I think there's some truth to that. But, you know, I don't know. I think I'm a little bit, I don't know if you followed Scott Galloway's comments about Apple Vision Pro, which is, you know, this isolating and anything that makes you unappealing to romantic partners is fundamentally not a good product. But I am generally of the belief that the technology will get better. I think you can certainly imagine a number of use cases where it's super helpful to have a device that allows you to be in interaction with people in the physical environment, but enhances, you know, in various ways, that experience. So I think it will happen. I just think it's going to happen quite slowly. And until we see
The third
iteration of Vision Pro or something interesting from Meta or Alphabet, you know, I think.
All right, go ahead, Brad.
What do you think about drone delivery? Because that's something shown in sci-fi all the time, and it's something that is happening in places like China and Dubai now, which with pretty interesting.
Well, I think it's going to be limited for a long time. I mean, first of all, just the sheer weight of packages is a limiting factor, at least in the current range of what drones can do. Like, it would be awesome if you could deliver a refrigerator via a drone, but that's, you know, what's called a helicopter. And I also just wonder, I keep using the example of mobile phones on airplanes, right? Like, we can do it. Right. Turns out that you don't need to be on airplane mode, right? The plane's not going to crash if people have the airplane mode on, but do we really want it? And I just think about a world where we're going to have all these, you know, if you just picture for a second, and I was explaining this to somebody the other day, like I happen to know a decent amount about stupid things like route density for delivery because of some jobs I've had in the past. And, you know, Amazon has been able to be amazingly efficient because they can just run a truck, you know, in like a 2-block area. You think of the sheer number of packages that get delivered within a mile of my house. I live in the city, so it's pretty busy. It's enormous. So even, you know, if 1% of those deliveries could be drones, you're just going to have drones constantly buzzing. And I think we're just not going to stand for that. So I think there's absolutely, aside from the physical limitations.
I want my pizza by drone, dude.
The pizza drone, exactly.
Pizza drone.
Like during the Super Bowl, you'll just hear them coming down the street, the pizza drone. The whole time. Okay, so
I think there's going to be a bigger market of people buying guns to shoot the drones down. How's that? That's my prediction.
Whoa. It's such an American thing.
That's an American thing.
It is an American thing. I'm
okay, so Steve, what we've been talking about here is that retailers, to survive, just to stay in business and not be one of the 100 retail chains that have gone out of business, you've got to have a kind of bold and decisive leadership. You've got to have a vision of what to do, and you've got to have the charisma to drive your team to achieve it. And that's a hard thing to do. Tell us a little bit about Leadership Lead, your Leader's Lead, your new book. Tell us what the point of that book is.
Well, the point is, and I've tried to sum it up a little bit, which is, if the world has changed so much, why have you changed so little? You know, we look at leaders, we look at companies that have been struggling. Department store is a great example. I pick on them too much, but department stores have been in decline for more than 20 years, yet the major chains, at least in North America, have done little of anything to change it. So what I'm trying to take on with Leaders Leap is, first of all, why do so many transformations fall short? What are the underlying reasons? And part of what I get into are errors of strategy, for sure. I propose some solutions that are more strategic in nature and kind of reframe the problems to a certain degree, but also really get into some of the personal characteristics of leaders that keep them from seeing what they need to do, or if they see it. Because I can tell you, I worked at Sears back in the day. We knew what was wrong. We had plenty of solutions. We just didn't do it. So how does ego get in the way of that? How does fear get in the way of that? How is there an unwillingness to say, you know, maybe what got me here isn't going to get me there, that I need to let go of some of the things that have served me well, because we are in a new world. There are, we've talked about a lot of technologies that are changing, but there's, you know, macroeconomic factors and things. So how do I open the aperture to a range of possibilities? How do I think about or have develop a willingness to blow up what I'm doing, to go through that creative destructive process to do something new? So what I try to lay out 7 different approaches, what I call mind leaps to reframe these issues. Because I think if, you know, leaders are the people, I mean, it's trite to say, but it's also true that, you know, Macy's isn't struggling, right? I mean, Macy's is struggling, but the reason it's struggling is because the leaders there have not been able to figure out what to do, or if they figured out what to do, they haven't been willing to aim higher, move faster, act more boldly in the face of all this disruption.
Tell me about it. I did a strategy meeting with the leadership at Macy's, and I was stunned at the level of resistance. It was an impenetrable wall of resistance. For every proposal or idea, they were like, we tried that, it didn't work. The customers won't go for it. It'll never, like, there was just this, they had convinced themselves that they couldn't take any action.
We just have to keep doing the same thing we're doing, but it's not working.
Yeah, but or next year will be the same as last year. Well, gosh, yeah. Steve, that sounds like a very important book. It's called Leaders Leap. It's by Steve Dennis. He's been our guest on The Futurist today.
There's thank you so very much. Here.
There it is, Leaders Leap, cool. Steve Dennis. Really fun. And also the author of Remarkable Retail. And that's a newsletter that he has as well. Really worth following if you're interested in retail. It touches so many aspects of the future. Thank you very much for joining us on the show, Steve. How can people stay in touch with you, and how can they learn about your latest work?
Well, I'm pretty active on social media, particularly LinkedIn. But of course, I have a website, which is Stephen with a V, the proper way to spell Stephen, by the way, StephenPDennis.com.
Very good. Great. Nice to see you. Thank you for joining us on The Futurist. Brett, it's always great to see you. I'm very happy we finally got in the same sync. You're not in the same time, but we found an hour that works. And folks, we love having you listen to our show. Every week, we'll be back with another futurist who will tell us about another angle or another aspect on the future and the world that's unfolding in front of us. I want to give a big shout out to Kevin, our engineer, to Lisbeth, our producer, and the folks at Provoke Media. They make the show possible. And I want to thank our fans for listening, the folks who write to us, who send us suggestions, and who provide provocative ideas and recommendations for speakers. We love hearing from you on social media, so please keep it up. And we'll be back next week with another Futurist. Until then, Brett, we will see you in
the future.
Well, that's it for The Futurists this week. If you liked the show, we sure hope you did. Please subscribe and share it with the people in your community. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review. That really helps other people find the show. And you can ping us anytime on Instagram and Twitter at Futurist Podcast. For the folks that you'd like to see on the show or the questions that you'd like us to ask. Thanks for joining. And as always, we'll see you in the future.